Okay, yeah, thanks a lot for the invitation to be here. It's been a really fun visit. I'm going to be talking about some work we completed with the Gaia first data release. That was released at the end of last year. And our paper came out in November. It's done with Caitlin Schutz, who's a grad student at UC Berkeley, and Ben Safdie, who's at Michigan, and Chi Liang is at MIT now. So to give a broad overview, we know that there's a lot of gravitational evidence for dark matter. So many of the ways we study dark matter is through its effects, its gravitational effects on large scales. And there, most of the models just assume the gravitational interactions, and that seems to work out pretty well. And on much, like on laboratory scales, we think about looking for dark matter particle interactions. For instance, direct detection experiments looking for dark matter nucleon scattering. And this kind of framework makes a lot of sense for models like WIMP dark matter, which are more or less don't interact on astrophysical scales. At the same time, while these are looking for dark matter standard model interactions, one compelling possibility is that the dark matter itself has some interactions. So in addition to, an analogy with the standard model having gauge interactions, we could imagine dark sector having some kind of new interactions. Or new gauge interactions. And this leads to very interesting effects on astrophysical scales for the dark matter. So for instance, if there's a new light mediator in this dark sector, there can be implications for things like dark matter self-interactions, which affect things like dwarf galaxies. It's also been used to try to explain various measurements of large-scale structure, as well as the galactic center GEV excess. And in at least several of these cases, often to have large enough effects, the hidden sector may have to be a fraction of the total dark matter, especially, for instance, if you want to have an observable effect on large-scale structure, but still be consistent with all the other observations.
So why would H-naught get affected by these dark sectors? Sorry.
It explains the discrepancy in the early time measurements and the late time measurements by there's a model which has an effect at high redshifts and less today, something like that.
It's one of these self-interacting, like it's a non-abelian.
Yeah. I don't remember all the details of this model, but and another interesting implication, if you have these kinds of light mediators in the dark sector, is that you can form dark matter disks. So normally we think of dark matter halos as forming with approximately spherical, that's not quite true, but approximately spherical dark matter halos, relatively fluffy, because there's no dissipation in the dark matter sector. But if there are these light mediators, then there could be also cooling mechanisms in the dark sector leading to a collapse into a disk-like structure. And for everything I'm going to assume that collapse, whatever disk-like structure there is in the dark matter, gets aligned with the baryonic disk. And this idea was proposed, it's been around for a while, but recently this idea has been discussed with estimates of how thick this thin dark matter disk would be. And this is a very rough estimate, but what they studied was given some this is a dark matter particle the dark sector contains of this dark matter particle, another light charged particle, so there's a huge mass difference between these, and this is the alpha dark analogous to alpha electromagnetism. So they mainly looked at things like Bremsstrahlung to estimate what the cooling rates were and to get a thickness for the dark matter disk. And so this two parsec thickness is much thinner than what the thickness of the baryonic disk is, which is more like 200 parsecs. So these are the kinds of processes that are relevant for the baryonic disk, things like here's the Bremsstrahlung, as well as atomic excitation lines. And so these processes allow emission of photons, which can escape the disk, leading to a cooling process. And so the same idea is what they have in mind for the dark matter disk. And again, by comparing analytic estimates of these cooling processes with some sort of temperature for the dark matter disk, they get the dark matter scale height. Of course, there's a big caveat that such thin dark disks may not be stable, and instead you get fragmentation into dark matter clumps. And so that was not so far included in trying to estimate how much of the dark matter would be in the dark matter disk. Nevertheless, if it's there, it's something that would have a lot of implications for dark matter searches and something we can test right now with the Gaia data.
So the picture is that you have some halo, which is roughly spherical, and then the disk in addition to that?
Yeah, so this dark matter cannot. The default model is it's a fraction of the dark matter which collapses into the disk, and there's also a dark matter halo.
So why is it that, so what sets the proportionality of what ends up in the disk and what ends up in the halo, and why is it that there's not a dynamical trend for one to go into the other one?
I think what they have in mind is just two different sectors, and it's a pretty arbitrary, so some of these implications include implications for direct detection, where you care a lot about whether you have a co-rotating dark matter component or not. It's also been used to try to explain other things like the plane of Andromeda satellites, the periodic comet impacts, and as well as the galactic center GVXS. So something to keep in mind is that for this dark matter disk to have an observable effect, the density, the local density, is very high. So this is a plot of the density profile as a function of height above and below the galactic plane. This is the usual dark matter NFW dark matter halo. These are the baryons, a model for the baryons. And this is the kind of thin dark disk that's needed for a number of the implications discussed here. So you see it's like a factor of few compared to the density and everything else. So one of these impacts has been discussed a lot. For instance, you have, because of a very thin dark matter disk, one can have oscillations of the sun above, through the disk above and below and so on, leading to periodic comet impacts. It's a little hard to see, but they try to fit this data to the periodicity of the oscillations of the sun, leading to dinosaur extinctions, maybe. And so that requires the kind of densities I just showed, which I'll give numbers to. So what are the constraints on this kind of thin dark disk? The existing work has used data from the Hipparchos, which is kind of the precursor of Gaia, in that it was also trying to do a complete survey of stellar kinematics. And so using the stellar kinematics from Hipparchos, Kramer and Randall set these bounds on the dark matter, dark disk surface density versus disk height. So for a given disk thickness, there's a upper bound on the allowed surface density or total mass in the dark disk. So this star is roughly the kind of the parameters needed for the periodic comet impacts or some of the other effects I talked about. And these are the 95% limits from Hipparchos. And so that's something that we can potentially improve on a lot with the Gaia. That I'll show we do improve on a lot with Gaia.
On this, this plot you're showing, mm-hmm. So the Schumerer criteria would make some line on this. And so where is that line?
I don't know what that line would look like on this plot. Don't know.
I'm just wondering if it's interesting to even consider these or not.
I think this is like you said, this is not stable.
Right.
But I don't know where the line goes. As a additional As a separate piece of our analysis, what we're going to do is just constrain what the total mid-plane density is of dark matter and baryons. And that, in turn, places a strong constraint on how much dark disk there is. So the Gaia satellite is providing a full sky survey of the stars in the Milky Way, including their positions, distances, and velocities. It was launched a couple of years ago, and the first data release was last year with about 1 million stars, as compared with what I just mentioned for Hipparchos, which is two orders of magnitude less, one or two. And eventually, it'll be order a billion stars with the next data release. So this will be a lot of information, and the information will be very precise. So this is a cartoon I've taken from one of my collaborators. The point is that Gaia is going to measure the positions and velocities extremely accurately. And the analogy here is if you're looking at the moon with the kind of angular resolution for Gaia, you can resolve, say, a quarter on the surface of the moon from Earth. And in terms of, I can now map that to kind of the observable quantities I want to know, which are these specific distances and positions. So this plot shows roughly what the kind of data we have and the kind of data that we're going to get. So this is the Hipparchos data set that I've mentioned. And what's been released so far are updated velocities, distances, and parallaxes for stars that are in common with a particular catalog, the Tycho 2 catalog, and the Gaia catalog, and that's these stars. And eventually what we'll get is the billion stars shown here down to with a much lower brightness cutoff. And so right now, the measurement uncertainties on the stars are somewhat limited by the fact that only stars in combination with this Tycho 2 catalog have the complete data we need. But still, that means for stars within, say, 300 parsecs, we get fairly good uncertainties on the distances, as well as very good, like, say, kilometer per second uncertainties on the velocities of the stars. But eventually, with the future data, Gaia data releases, these uncertainties will go down quite a bit. There will be the full 6D information, including the line of sight velocities, as well as many more stars. And so that's exciting because there's a lot of different potential dark matter applications for this data set. So one thing that is being done and will be done is a better measurement of the local dark matter density. That's something we're able to probe already with the limited data set we have now. One can try to infer things about the dark matter velocity distribution by looking at the velocity distribution of halo stars. And one can try to measure the dark matter halo profile, which is important for indirect detection, for instance. And another particularly exciting aspect is we might now be able to probe more aspects of dark matter substructure, including thin dark matter disks, thick dark matter disks, as well as dark matter subhalos. So I want to mention one other possible dark matter disk, which doesn't rely on the dissipations that I mentioned earlier. So it's also been claimed in the literature that you can have a thick dark matter disk, and this is a kind of dynamical friction effect where the baryons in the disk lead to a small overdensity of the dark matter where the baryons are. So there's some sort of drag of the baryons on the dark matter leading to a thick dark matter disk. And this is, I call it a thick dark matter disk because it's much thicker than the actual profile of the baryons. So this is something that looks locally just a lot like a overdensity in the dark matter halo. So that's a thick dark matter disk, and this is the halo, for instance. And that's something with future data we can look for. And again, it's only dependent on the gravitational effects. But what we can already do immediately is look for a thin dark matter disk, because it's within kind of the volume where we have very good measurement uncertainties for Gaia. So I'm going to parameterize this thin dark disk again by the surface density and the scale height. And here is, for example, the kind of, just to give a preview, this is the kind of dark disk profile that I'll be able to constrain, that we constrain with the new data. Okay. Questions? Okay, so in the next part of my talk, I'll discuss the procedure for trying to look for the local dark matter density and a dark disk. So the basic idea is that very similar to measurements of rotation curves, we have some tracer population of stars or gas, which are sensitive to the total gravitating mass, and we want to model that and try to understand what the mass enclosed is, except for now we're doing it in the z direction. So the starting point is, as usual, the Boltzmann equation. So we treat some population of stars as being in equilibrium so that this derivative is zero. This time derivative is zero. And making some assumptions about the functional form of the phase space distribution, we can get that the velocity distribution of the tracer population is related to the density profile. Okay, so this is the basic relation I'm going to use. If I know something about the velocity distribution, and here specifically I mean the vertical velocities, if I know the gravitational potential, or if I have some model for it, then I can get some output for the number density of that tracer population. So the simple way to say it is that if I have more gravitating matter for a given mid-plane velocity dispersion, I'll predict a more or less pinched profile. So here's an example with some subset of my data that we'll look at. And this is the velocity distribution of a set of tracer stars. And this is velocities in and out of the plane. And for the kind of default model for the amount of baryons and so on, I can predict what the density profile is for that tracer, which is given by this line. But if I add in some more dark matter, then it gets more pinched, giving this red dashed line. Okay.
So are you just like applying just like the vertical genes equation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And at the same time, I need to know something about the gravitational potential. Oh, is that what you're going to ask?
The words appeared, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So now I need a model for the gravitational potential. And so here, I'm going to have to make a couple more assumptions regarding the what those different mass components look like. And so the idea is that things are simplified, and it's a good approximation to assume most of the mass components are close to isothermal near the plane where I'm looking. So that means the velocity distribution is just Gaussian with this velocity dispersion, and I have a density profile which is fixed by the potential. And so I can solve these together with some input for the baryonic central densities and velocity dispersions, and get a model for the gravitational potential. So the kinds of things I will put in this model are, I'll put density components due to the baryons, the smooth dark matter halo, and the dark disk, and then solve for the potential, and then try to iterate and see what I get. So the models for the baryons have fluctuated over recent years, say, but the basic components are, there's couple of gas components and a number of stellar components. And especially for the stellar midplane densities and velocity dispersions, there's a lot of improvement over the past couple of years, including with Gaia data itself, because that's something where it's a little more straightforward to model and to measure directly. The gas components are more difficult to model. And so what we've taken here are some of the most recent compiled measurements from, say, McKee et al., 2015. But if you look at different papers in the past couple of years, the amount of, say, cold atomic gas versus molecular gas does fluctuate quite a lot. So these contain the biggest uncertainties in doing this kind of analysis. But we are going to marginalize over at least the quoted uncertainties on the gas densities. I just want to draw attention to this because it is effectively a systematic. So any result we have for the, say, dark matter density is subject to any hidden systematics in the gas density, for instance. And so this shows the solution for these various different mass components. So my mass model consists of these. Well, it's been lumped into a couple different categories. And if I solve for the potential and the density profiles, assuming no dark disk, then these are the kinds of density profiles I get. And then, for instance, including a dark disk, everything, again, gets pinched more towards the galactic plane. And so what some of the some past analyses, what they've done is they've compared the measured central densities of these various mass components, and they've extrapolated out to a kiloparsec, and then they've compared that with the measured gravitational potential at a kiloparsec. And what was especially pointed out in Kramer and Randall was that because the dark disk changes the density profiles of these mass components, it's better to self-consistently try to include the dark disk near the plane and model the profiles of these. Because the extrapolated mass of these mass components is different depending on whether the dark disk is there or not.
That's a good question. So when these models were made, mm-hmm. How are they? When you say they're extrapolated, you mean we're taking measurements of atomic gas and measurements of M stars,
yeah.
Sort of in most of the disk and kind of extrapolating to what we think they're at the very center of the disk? Is that basically it?
Well, so they were taking, say, this model,
yeah.
Integrating out to a kiloparsec, and then that gives them total surface density of baryons. Mm-hmm. Then they compare with total surface density measured, and they say the difference is how much dark disk is allowed. Which is not quite how you want to do it, because if the dark disk is there, it changes what the integrated surface density is for the baryons.
So you're saying I have something like an integrated surface density of the atomic gas by looking and seeing how much emission I get in like H2 lines or something like this?
Yeah. So yeah, the measurement of those is difficult, so it's okay. Hard to extrapolate out to kiloparsec.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how the backgrounds are being modeled here. So mm-hmm. I'm looking in one direction, and I get a total brightness from M stars, and I get a total brightness from mm-hmm. atomic gas. And then I model that as a density distribution, but I should model that as a different density distribution if I have a dark
yeah.
disk. This is the idea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. And so using this model now for the... So I have this model for the baryons. I get the gravitational potential. And now I'm going to discuss using Gaia data with a tracer population of stars within this kind of cylinder of order a few hundred parsecs to try to fit both the velocity distribution and number density to the data, trying to include all of these nuisance parameters and so on. OK, so that's the next part. Questions? Okay, so the main advantage of Gaia are that A, the measurement uncertainties are going to be much smaller, and already so that implies measurements out to larger distances as well as measurements of much fainter stars, and so if we look at the number densities of stars by brightness. There are many more faint stars than there are bright stars. So even with a somewhat modest, I guess, improvement in the brightness cut, we will get many more observed stars for Gaia. And so I just want to point out here what we're doing is we're going to, so there's different stellar types labeled by the color. And we're going to split up our analysis into a couple of different populations, namely A, F, and G stars, where these are getting, I think of these as older stars. Okay, and the reason that's important is because different tracer stars have different potential systematics. So everything I've done so far assumes that equilibrium is a very good approximation near the disk. But there is some evidence that maybe there's departures from equilibrium, for example, with the presence of vertical density waves. So here, the plot on the right shows, for example, this is like a vertical density wave. And also, there's kind of asymmetries in the net, in the velocities in the z direction. That's sort of this trend here. But this is typically on larger scales than we look at. For example, this is on kiloparsec scales. So we think that these should not be too relevant. But the idea is that if there was a past event, then it can affect different populations differently because of their different main sequence lifetimes. So where the A stars are the youngest, they may be sensitive to a different. They may not be sensitive to a passing subhalo that happened more than a billion years ago, where the older stars might be. So at least it was pointed out in some papers by Woodrow et al. That that if you have if these effects are present in the data and they're not modeled, then they can lead to big differences in what you infer from different populations. So you might infer a very different dark matter density from different populations if due to non-equilibrium effects that are unmodeled. Okay, so the way our approach is that, one, we think these effects should not be very big close to the disk. And that's also borne out by some studies by Garbari et al. Two, we try to be conservative about our uncertainties. So we kind of include additional systematic uncertainties to account for possible asymmetries or non-equilibrium effects. And then we scan over those. And finally, we look at different tracer populations to try to judge whether this is an important effect. Okay. But so here's our data. This is the velocity distributions of those three tracer stars that I mentioned, A, F, and G stars. What we saw with the data is that they're all good fits to, you know, just Gaussian distributions, which we expect if they're close to equilibrium. And there's no significant asymmetries in the plus z velocities versus the minus z velocities. And so we think that this approximation of being close to equilibrium is a good one. Okay, so given these velocity distributions, here are the predicted number density profiles. So this shows, for those populations, the best fit to the number density profile if we assume the presence of no dark disk. And here, the best fit halo dark matter turns out to be about 0.5 GeV per centimeter cubed, which is exactly kind of the values we typically assume, or is consistent with the existing measurements of the local dark matter density done at 1 kiloparsec. Now, if I just take this best fit,
Just ask, this may be obvious, but if we change the local dark matter density that's just in the halo, what effect does that have on the data that you'd see?
It also leads to some amount of pinching.
It's maybe the same. It's fairly degenerate-ish with that.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So if I just take that and now I inject the kind of dark disk needed for the periodic comet impacts, that's what happens to the predicted number density profiles. So already by eye, we can see that this kind of dark disk is a pretty big effect given the kind of statistics we have with Gaia. And now I have to, you know, include marginalized sample over all the other parameters, and it won't be quite as dramatic as this, but it will still be, we will still be able to constrain that size dark disk.
So just to reinforce, mm-hmm. So you chose 0.5 GB per centimeter cubed in order to be conservative, because as that number is wrapped up, you'll get more pinching.
No, this was just a fit. This was the best fit value.
Well, it was actually just the best.
Yeah, with a default baryonic, with a default baryonic model, so it scans over the baryon parameters given the uncertainties, but just, including just baryons and dark matter.
Do you know what the uncertainties on that end up being?
I'll show you some results on that. And this is a combined fit to all three populations. Okay. All right, so then with this, let me show you the actual results, the actual bounds. The data that we're using are the velocity distributions and the number density profiles. So what we want to do was to account for various, we want to account for a number of things that were not all accounted for previously. For instance, typically there's a mass model for the baryons, which was just fixed, and we want to, allow for the fact that allow sample over the baryons according to what the quoted uncertainties are. We also want to account for the fact that you can have fluctuations in the velocity distributions. So, for instance, for the A stars, we have relatively low statistics, and so what we have in mind is that there's a true velocity distribution subject to some statistical fluctuations, and what we model now, a parameter in our fit is the true velocity distribution. And we include a number of other parameters, so on. So in total, we have a lot of different parameters we scan over, and scanning over these, for every dark disk scale height, we can now set an upper limit on the surface density. And here we used profile likelihoods. It's good that there's a line here. Okay, so these are our final results. This is the, again, for every scale height, the upper bound on the dark disk surface density. The previous result using Hipparchos data, the most similar analysis to ours, perhaps, is given by this line here. This is our bound from the first Gaia data release, and this is the preferred benchmark points for the various results I discussed earlier, including the periodic comet impacts. So
for comparison, what's like the surface density for our like stellar disk?
The total surface density?
Yeah, just to sort of like get this a scale for me.
The only thing is there I have to integrate out to like 300 or 500 parsecs, and that's beyond. But then it would be about 50.
Okay, so this is like a tenth or something of the surface density.
Yeah.
And the scale height for our stellar disk is like comparable values, like
it's more like 200. Yeah. So, another, I guess another way to put it is, let me see, if I take the this line where we are, on this line, the midplane density is fairly close to the baryonic midplane density. It's a little bit lower, but it is around that. So I guess, the way we were thinking about it is more, what is the midplane density that that is constrained? So this midplane density is sort of, if you take the mass model for the baryons and you add that up, you get some midplane density, and then there's some error bars on that. But accounting for that, it's about, 50. And accounting for the fact that the data prefers a bit of dark matter too, then we end up with about half, 50% of the baryonic midplane density is on this line is about 50% of the baryonic midplane density.
This is the scale height, how far from the center of the galaxy?
Here.
Here where we are?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, what is it, 8 kiloparsecs?
Yeah. And so if you assume, as Kramer and Randall did at some point, if you assume that the radial profile of the dark disk is the same as the radial profile of the baryonic disk, it implies that the dark matter density, the total dark matter in the disk, should be much less than 1% of the total dark matter.
When you say that the expectations were drawn using a default baryon mass model, mm-hmm. does that mean you didn't do the correction from the dark disk itself? What does the default mean?
It just means that different papers quote different atomic hydrogen uncertainties, or different atomic hydrogen midplane values and uncertainties, and we used one particular paper for this case. Okay, so yeah, so you can hardly see it, but there is a band here. If we just took, this is a somewhat high rho dark matter. This is about, I think, 0.6 or even 0.7 in GeV per centimeter cubed. But it shows that's the kind of, that this band here is what you would expect for that kind of dark matter density. Okay, so specifically the things that allowed us to get much better constraints are that there was a huge improvement in the statistics with DR1, so we have over an order of magnitude more stars. We also go out to larger distances from the galactic midplane, which is important because the kind of pinching effect becomes more dramatic as you go further out. And we did do a slightly different analysis where now what we do is we include lots of nuisance parameters versus the method in this paper. But at least, for instance, what this paper did effectively was only use the A stars, whereas we have AFG. And if we look at only the A stars, it turns out to be quite similar to their results. So we think that this is a natural, what we find now is natural given, you know, the improvements in statistics and distances. And these bounds or the results we get are fairly robust to various ways we treat the data, such as different binnings, as well as this was the different mass models. So for instance, Kramer and Randall claim gas densities, which are lower by about 25% or so. And so you would think this, in general, can imply that you, given lower gas densities, this implies that you can, you know, put more dark matter in, which is true, but it's just not enough to, it's not enough to get to the kind of dark disk parameters that they want. Lastly, I mentioned we wanted to look at different bounds by population to make sure that, you know, the results made sense. And so these lines are what we get for different populations. And A stars, there's a way fewer of them compared to F and G stars, so that's why they're a lot weaker. But otherwise, things are fairly consistent across the different populations. So there are some differences between, say, G stars and F stars, given that they have similar statistics. And that's something that will be really interesting to see with the future Gaia data, because right now we don't know if those differences are due to, say, measurement errors, because the G stars are fainter, or because they, again, have different main sequence lifetimes and are sensitive to different, say, perturbations in the past. And so checking this kind of non-equilibrium behavior, something that we can do once we have, again, the full 60 information and more data.
Just to ask, if you took your sample populations that you generated, mm-hmm. is that a much bigger deviation between F and G than you expect?
It's a somewhat bigger, yeah. Yeah, it is a little bit.
So what is the TS here?
Between F and G.
So no, what does max TS on the right-hand plot mean?
Oh, sorry, you're asking about this plot. This is for a given We take a given dark disk scale height and we scan over what the surface density is, and the max TS is how much of a improvement in the fit do you get once you include the dark disk.
Just in chi-squared terms.
Yeah, yeah. So just improvement in chi-squared. So it's a fairly modest improvement. But yeah, the joint analysis, you get chi-squared improvement of about 5 if you include a dark disk versus if you don't. So at least for these kinds of analyses, we think this is not very significant. Okay. So it's
this is once you've already included a NFW halo background.
Yeah.
That's a nuisance parameter that's already.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you can also see it in this plot a little bit where the band, if you only have halo dark matter, is this, and then the limit is here. So there's a little bit of a deviation, which implies for various reasons, for whatever reason, the fit prefers, or the data prefers to fit, have a fit with a very thin dark disk of scale of surface density around 6 or so. Mm-hmm. But the chi-square difference is not very significant. And we can also try to measure what the best dark disk parameters we would get are. And that's what these various contours show. So again, you see that the 1 sigma contours are all pretty much consistent with 0 surface density. Maybe you get a mild preference for, again, a thin or for a dark disk here. But the thin dark disk scenario for the periodic comet impacts and so on is definitely outside of those. And here you can see the kind of degeneracy you mentioned between the halo dark matter and the dark disk. So here, if I increase the halo dark matter, I get kind of this anti-correlation with the surface density. So it's hard for us to distinguish those two. But now let's throw away the dark disk completely and try to just get a measurement of the local mid-plane density and the local dark matter density. So this plot is our measurements of the total baryonic midplane density versus the total dark matter halo, total dark matter density in the halo. And what we get are mild, somewhat, like say 2 sigma in some of these populations, evidence for a local dark matter density very close to the kind of value that is measured at 1 kiloparsec.
So does 1 kiloparsec mean 1 kiloparsec from the galactic center?
1 kiloparsec above and below the plane.
Oh, right. But so are the usual measurements done at our location?
Yeah, the usual measurements are done at our location, but at a height of 1 kiloparsec, whereas this is done at a height of, within a volume of 100 or 200 parsecs. So it's much more local than the usual quoted local dark matter densities.
What kind of evidence do they get away from zero?
The other ones?
Yeah.
Those are more significant, and the error bars are smaller, but different people quote very different error bars. Yeah. And so for us, again, these are error bars, including all of the different uncertainties we've included. So for instance, for the the A stars, we get almost 2 sigma. It's less obvious in the G stars, for instance, but they all seem roughly consistent with the value that we expect. And that was obtained in our best fit.
So the A star's preference for really high local dark matter density, should I just ascribe that to the fact that these are not necessarily equilibrated yet? Or
That's one argument that you can make. There are people who argue that the A stars are too sensitive to the local gas fluctuations because they're fairly young. And so there have been a couple of other papers doing a total measurement of the midplane density. This is something fairly standard within this community. And they've done that with Gaia DR1, but I think ours is the only one that decomposes and try to measure the local dark matter density. And as far as I know, I think it's also the only Gaia DR1 paper so far that presented any local dark matter density, whether at 200 parsecs or 1 kiloparsec. Okay, so we made new measurements of the local dark matter density, and our bounds on dark disks also essentially rule out a lot of these scenarios that I mentioned. So again, a lot of these scenarios, the parameter space is quite twiddly, quite approximate. So, you know, it's possible that what we've ruled out isn't going to rule out the idea of dissipative dark matter, and it doesn't completely rule out interesting effects from dark disks. But at least what's been quoted in the literature is in conflict with new data. And so just to wrap up, we can have hidden sector dark matter with light mediators that leading to dissipation and thin dark disks. And using the first Gaia data release, we place new bounds on the kind of scenario being proposed for things like periodic comet impacts. And we made the first measurements of the local dark matter density with Gaia. And this, as I mentioned earlier, this is only a small fraction of the total Gaia data that will be available. There's going to be three orders of magnitude more stars and way better measurement uncertainties. And so it's a very exciting time to do, you know, lots of dark matter studies with Gaia. So thanks a lot.
So do you have any predictions for how much better things like the local dark matter density measurement will be once you have the rest of Gaia data?
So with the kind of analysis we did, the improvements with future Gaia data will be somewhat limited because our analysis assumed equilibrium. And we said that was fine because we're only looking within a few hundred parsecs. Mm-hmm. So within a few hundred parsecs, we're not going to get a lot of improvement. So there will be more stars, but those stars, the fainter stars, have very flat profiles. So their sensitivity to the dark disk is actually, or dark matter, is even lower. So we expect it to be fairly marginal with this kind of analysis. However, if you now go out to larger distances, include the full departures from constant velocity dispersion, then there should be improvements. I don't know that, the numbers.
Is there any value, you know, to using like metallicities of the stars besides just like, the stellar type that you've used here?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think the argument is that the tracer populations labeled by metallicity are more likely to be close to equilibrium. So these are the maps being used, MAP, monoabundance populations being used. Yeah. And they claim that when they separate it by metallicity, it seems like the populations are very close to equilibrium or have isothermal
for each population, yeah, separately. Whereas here, I guess so if you ignore metallicity, then mm-hmm. you're mixing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see.
Exactly, yeah. So, do you think
these are the like low iron mm-hmm. metallicity stars?
Yeah.
Particularly, those are supposed to be good.
Yeah. Particles. Yeah, which is kind of an orthogonal classification as we did here.
Are these things where you had the different distributions for these different classes of stars something in line with what you would have predicted?
Yes. Yeah.
Like things of different ages, mm-hmm. different, and they all have different histories. But can you predict what you'd expect given different things that have encountered during the history, and how well does that match up with what you see?
You're asking if what the explanation is for the say A stars having a particular velocity dispersion.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
How worried should we be about the F and G star discrepancy, given that you're expecting to find a best fit surface density as a function mm-hmm. of height that where they match, and they really don't look like they match very much?
Yeah, I think it's a little hard to say. I think part of it might be the measurement uncertainties because we have somewhat large parallax errors going out to for the G stars out at large heights from the galactic plane. And well, we've modeled that, but we're not 100% sure that I think with better uncertainties, it'll become more clear.
So it could be a problem with the actual a systematic effect in the heights or the distances
yeah.
from the satellite of the actual G stars. Right?
Yeah. Because at least the way we've modeled it, and this is quite standard, I think, is we've taken the observed uncertainties on the distances. We've applied that to our model, like smeared out the prediction with the measured uncertainties, the averaged measured uncertainties. But I think it's possible that those are, if those are underestimated, or if not, they're the spread from the average, which we didn't model, has a big enough effect, then it's possible that's affecting the answer a little bit.
So will streams be useful for this, do you think?
What's that?
So things like the cold streams uh-huh. be useful for this or not?
For dark disks or?
I guess, yes, we know that streams will be useful for like the overall halo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Ressa, maybe for like these like thin dark disks, will they help?
They have to pass through the disk.
We have like globular clusters
uh-huh.
that are passing through that are having streams coming off of them. I don't know. I mean, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess.
I haven't really thought about like numerically if the constraints from those would be useful or not.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think there might have been one paper looking at disruption of maybe binaries or something.
Binary stars.
I think so. I can't to look at that again.
Disruption caused by this like thin dark matter disk.
It was a paper by Jesus Zavala.
Jesus Zavala.
That's what I thought it was about, but I'm trying to remember.
That seems surprising. January 16th, so you can
bother. What
was that? Yeah, I noticed he'll be here January 16th, so we can bother.
Oh.
I'll be here.
Cool. Thank all our speakers.
Thanks.